Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the so-called money media election complex keeps distorting the democratic process. How did we get here and where are we headed? And then how did the Congress become so antagonistic in just three decades? What are the consequences and what can be done to repair the system? The 2012 elections cost more than $10 billion, says our next guest, and what amounts to what he calls the money and media election complex, a system that informs fewer and fewer voters about the realities of the candidates or the public policy consequences of the vote. How did we get here and where are we headed? Robert McChesney joins us. He is a professor of communication at the University of Illinois. His books include Digital Disconnect, The Death and Life of American Journalism, and his most recent, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Bob McChesney. It's great to have you back with us.
My pleasure to be here, Maria.
Let's start with today's socioeconomic system. You've equated it to really the days of the robber barons. Where do you see that the most?
We call the current system in the United States a dollarocracy as opposed to democracy. I think the evidence is fairly clear now, and I think few people who live in this country would see it any other way at this point in time. We don't really have one person, one vote, and the rule of the people guiding our country. It's $1, one vote, and the rule of money that guides this country. On virtually every issue that matters, where money is involved, where there's powerful interests, wealthy interests have a stake in it, money rules, money wins. That doesn't mean a specific corporate lobby always wins, because they might be squaring off against another one, and then you've got political battle. But it's always about money. And in fact, Marie, in the last 2 years, there have been two or three major studies done independently by leading political scientists from schools like Berkeley and Yale and Virginia and Princeton that have been published by Princeton University Press that have concluded that if you look at the United States government, the interests, the positions, the values, the opinions of the great bulk of Americans, working class and middle class Americans, have absolutely no influence over core policy. If you want to understand the core policies that are made on economics, foreign policy, environmental policy, consumer policy, labor policy, you can basically understand the range of debate by looking at the top 1%, that those with money really control the board of governance. And that's dollarocracy. That means democracy, which is supposed to be the rule of the people, doesn't exist. And we see it really on every area. As I said, there's not any one where it sticks out here and not there. And in our view, why we wrote this book, is that elections are sort of the one Achilles heel in dollarocracy situation. Elections are the one moment that Bill Gates, the heirs to the Walmart fortune, and the head of a hedge fund are all have the same amount of power as the person who cleans latrines at Walmart on the graveyard shift. They're equals on that one day when they go into the ballot box. And because of that, powerful interests, ever since democracy came along, you had elections, have been scared to death of democracy, scared to death of elections, and they've tried to do whatever they can to minimize the threat of democracy to their unequal control over the society's resources.
One of the things I liked about your book, this particular one, there are two kind of aspects that came together. One was you had this sort of systems look at the elections and the media and the influence. And the other was the kind of historic aspect, how this all came about from the courts, from the mass media, and all of that together. So I'd like to take a look at all of these. First, from the systemic aspect, you sort of coined a new phrase. You're calling it the money media election complex. How do you see this system?
Well, we've got, in the last election cycle, the 2012 cycle, over $10 billion was spent on the election, on the various campaigns for all the races in the country. This was well over twice what was spent just 4 years earlier. And even factoring in inflation, a good 10 times what was spent just a generation earlier. It's an enormous increase, and it's only going to go up. It's going to continue escalating into the visible future. And what we have as a result of this is a huge industry now. And you have consultants, you have super PACs that Karl Rove and all these people have organized that are basically shadowy groups that have figured out using loopholes at the revenue service how to hide their donations so the public never knows who gives the money that buys all these ads. And we also have a hugest part, the largest, most important part of the money and media election complex are the media themselves. The news media, the commercial broadcasters get most of that $10 billion in the form of payment for political advertising. And that makes this lobby, this organization, these few companies that own most of the local TV stations, powerful advocates of the status quo. And the commercial television station-owning companies are to campaign finance reform what the National Rifle Association is to efforts to ban assault weapons. I mean, they are the strong, powerful lobby to keep the money flowing into their pockets so they can keep running these ads and prevent any sort of reform of campaigns. Now, to some extent, the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision took the whole issue out of the hands of policymakers. It said basically no law can prohibit or limit the ability of corporations and billionaires to spend whatever they want on campaigns. That's their constitutional right now. They've inscribed a brand new right never before recognized in the American Constitution, the right to buy an election. And it is now a sacred right, according to the five members of the U.S. Supreme Court. In our book, too, and this gets to the historical part, I'm glad you picked up on the importance. Our argument is that from the beginning of the United States, there's always been a tension between the property owners who had a lot of property and the great mass of people who had very little or no property or no property of great consequence. And, you know, in a democracy, the few with the much are always fearful of the many with little, that it will threaten them. And for that reason, at the founding of the Republic, John Adams, James Madison were very much opposed to universal adult white male suffrage, let alone letting women or people of color vote. They didn't like the idea of people without property voting. They didn't think they'd be trusted to understand who the proper rulers of society ought to be. And I think that this tension has played out throughout American history. And I think if I can generalize grossly, you know, we go through periods in which there is those with a great deal of property increase their power, and then we have periods in which the popular forces are in ascension. So if you look at the Jacksonian era, that in the 30s, that was a popular period. Reconstruction, a popular period. The Progressive era, following the Gilded Age, a popular era. The New Deal, following the Roaring Twenties, a popular era. And then the last great popular uprising in the United States was the 1960s and early 1970s. And that's the last one, and why that's especially important and why we emphasize that last period in the book is that that was a period in which the corporate community in America really freaked out. They were looking at the landscape of America in the late 1960s and early 1970s, and what they saw was that business was held in very low regard by historical standards by many Americans, and that middle-class kids, who normally were very pro-business and rah-rah free enterprise, were singularly hostile to corporations and big business, and where there was a great deal of sympathy for social democracy, for left-wing policies, for egalitarian ideas. And the result of this, the Chamber of Commerce, corporations, went into a dedicated campaign to sort of take control of the government and put it in the hands of business and make business again the rightful rulers of society. And that was what we chronicle in the book. A key part of that movement, and it operated on many fronts, though, was to make the Supreme Court be more sympathetic to corporate interests. And in that, from the very beginning, a key battle that's been fought was to take any limits off the campaign spending of billionaires and corporations. Lewis Powell, the Supreme Court justice, who we chronicle a great depth in the length in the book, actually wrote a now famous memo in 1971 for the Chamber of Commerce that was distributed to all the heads, CEOs of the major corporations in America as a confidential memo saying, look, you've got to start spending money on lobbying. You've got to start spending money on candidates. You've got to start spending money to take over the media and to get universities to be more sympathetic. And we've got to take over the courts. We've basically got to make a frontal assault on the people running this country and get people who are sympathetic to business to be in charge. And this is what we chronicle in the book. And a key part of it was getting rid of any limitations on the wealthy to take over elections, because they know that if you can spend as much money as you want, the people with the most money can dominate elections. And that's exactly what they want, because they're scared to death of real democracy.
And as I understand it, it was really aimed at also changing the ideology that was starting to already shift in another direction in the U.S. And that's why the educational institutions and the media were so important.
That's right. They had to basically put the idea in people's head that this was the best of all possible worlds and you should not be interested in politics. They really were obsessed with depoliticizing the society. In a famous document from 1979 by a group called the Trilateral Commission, this is sort of an establishment group, they argue that the great problem in America in the 60s and early 70s was that traditionally apathetic populations, women, people of color, especially African Americans, young people, young workers, were getting uppity. They were making demands on the system, and the system only really worked best when they were apathetic and they let the traditional rulers run the society. You could have a democracy. And democracy didn't work when there was to put it bluntly, too much democracy. And they said, what we've got to do is get the traditionally apathetic parts of the population to become apathetic again, to give up any hope that they could do anything politically, and just to go take care of their personal lives, their private lives, get loaded, just do what they do, but let the rulers run the country without their interference. And so that's a crude way to put it, but that's how they were talking among themselves. That's how they were thinking. They wouldn't put that in their public relations. And that's what the ideology is. Take care of number one, shop till you drop, but never ever think that we could have a better, more just, a more fair world.
You spoke quite a bit about Lewis Powell, especially his role prior to being on the court, and then you talk a bit about his role on the court, like the Bilotti decision. But then you go on and say that another key architect of this system is really John Roberts, our current Supreme Court Chief Justice. Why John Roberts more than any of the others?
Well, John Roberts is the product of dollarocracy. You know, starting in the 1970s and 80s, the Federalist Society was created, and the mission of the Federalist Society was to make sure that the judges on the courts, that Republicans in particular appointed, but even Democrats, but that the Republicans especially appointed, would be very much committed to preserving the dominance of business and wealthy people in American society and business interests, and downplaying labor and popular politics. Since the 1970s, no Republican appointee to the Supreme Court has gone rogue. You know, it used to be you get guys like Earl Warren or Harry Blackmun who'd be appointed by Republicans who are moderate, middle-of-the-road types, and then they get on the court and they would have the freedom and liberty to think through issues, and they'd oftentimes surprise people. Or John Paul Stevens, another great Republican appointee, surprise people and become, you know, distinguished jurists and who would be considered quite liberal because they were honest, credible public servants. Well, in the new era, judges are now carefully sort of brought through a right-wing farm system, and you make sure you're getting a pure indoctrinated right-wing ideologue who's in with the program before they get appointed any serious court position. And that's when you get your Scalias, your Alitos, your Clarence Thomases, and now your Roberts. And Roberts is probably the champion. He's a pure political ideologue. We were surprised, at least I was, the more I studied Roberts, to see what a hack the guy is. When the Citizens United case first came before the Supreme Court, it was being argued on very narrow grounds. It wasn't all about getting rid of any bans on billionaire corporate spending on political campaigns. And both sides were arguing it on narrow grounds that wouldn't have really affected the law dramatically, however it was ruled. And Roberts said, send it back, said, I want you to re-argue this and make it much broader. Because Roberts knew what he wanted. He knew the opinion he wanted to write. He needed a case, though, so he could write his opinion. Roberts was committed to getting rid of any limits on billionaire or corporate spending on elections from the moment he got on the court, if not long before that. In the same vein, the other side of the same coin, where Robert, we knew his opinion even before he ever got a case, was the recent Voting Rights Act that came before the Supreme Court. Because the other side of the coin of unleashing corporate and billionaire money to buy elections, the other side of the coin is suppressing the vote of people who won't vote for dollarcrats. And this means especially black people, young people, students, immigrants, Latinos. And when the Supreme Court ruled on its Voting Rights Act and voted 5-4 to basically abandon enforcement of the Voting Rights Act in the South, it was known that Roberts would do that all along, because you knew this is mission critical to dollarocracy. So southern states and any state could now easily make it much more difficult for Democratic voters not to vote, which is the whole idea. And he delivered the goods. Those were two cases. I mean, the corruption and the cynicism and the shamelessness of this court, it's difficult to exaggerate. We chronicle it in the book how just deeply flawed and absurd their defense in Citizens United was, even at the time, and it immediately blew up their claims about it in the 2012 election. Yet we can be certain that Roberts will never revisit and say we made a mistake. That one, as far as he's concerned, I'm sure, is locked in for all time, or until what John and I argue needs to be done. There's a constitutional amendment that basically overrides what they've done.
There was an article in the New York Times just after the Supreme Court ended its term about John Roberts in particular. It argued that he was very strategic about how he worked the court members themselves, getting the four liberal members to sign on to some opinions, getting them to kind of come up with something moderate, so that he could later use their consensus against them.
Well, yes. I think he is very strategic. There's certain things that are absolutely mission critical that are non-negotiable. Getting rid of the Voting Rights Act, non-negotiable. Letting billionaires buy elections, non-negotiable. Letting corporations have the same rights as individuals, non-negotiable. But everything else is negotiable. I mean, it's on those corporate and class issues that he's always going to deliver the goods for his benefactors. But otherwise, and there are a lot of cases, you know, the health insurance case he had before, gay rights. You know, there he's willing to talk turkey, and he's willing to do what he has to do so he can get away with the stuff that really matters to him.
Those are the cases, those that you say are non-negotiable, that he then incorporates past consensus opinions from the more liberal justices to justify this. So then there are also, of course, cases that came down. One that you noted was Knox versus SEIU, which also disempowered another foe of corporations, which are the unions.
Crucial to the whole dollarocracy movement since the 70s has been the elimination of unions in the United States. And this is for two reasons. The first one, which is obvious, is that corporations don't like unions because they give workers more wages, they cut into profits in the minds of the CEO, and no business really wants workers having any leverage or control over the workplace. They want to control it themselves, so there's always a battle there. If you don't have unions, then companies can more or less do whatever the heck they want, and that's why companies like Walmart do everything in their power to prevent there being unions. But the other reason, and every bit as important, for why Lewis Powell, the Chamber of Commerce and Corporate America declared war on unions and attempted, with a large degree of success, to eliminate them, is their political power. Because unions are the only force in the United States, traditionally, and into the 70s, that could raise sufficient funds to organize people to actually win elections against corporate America when corporate America threw all its money into a race. They're the only force that could actually still defeat them. And so getting rid of private sector unions has been job one. They succeeded at that by the early 80s. And what I mean by that is there's been no new major private sector unions formed since the early 80s. It's virtually impossible to start a private sector union now. The rules have been rigged so badly against workers, even though the polling shows that a majority of non-union workers in private sector jobs would love to have a union. They'd love to have the opportunity, but they just don't get that opportunity. So they've won that battle. It's been a major victory. And now they're turning their sights on the only unions that have survived, the public sector unions, which have been able to survive because state governments have been prohibited from using the corporate union-busting tactics. But now we see in numerous states, including Wisconsin, with Scott Walker, they're finding ways to smash these unions to the best of their ability. And once they get rid of public sector unions, especially the teachers' union, then it's open season for the corporate community to sink their teeth into that public education budget.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with Robert McChesney about his new book, Dollarocracy. Let's think about the other big element in a democracy, which is the voter. When I see all this that you have been laying out, and I think the ultimate onus does fall at the feet of the voter. Given today, with so much information out there, although it is kind of a morass, what is it that keeps the voters from learning and from participating in a meaningful way?
I'm actually very sympathetic to the American voter and what they go through. You know, the United States only votes by far at the lowest rate of any major democracy. We have, the last election, 52% of the eligible population voted in of the adult population, below any other advanced democracy in the world. The standard rate in most democracies is 65, 70, 75%, rates we have not had in this country since the 19th century among eligible voters. If you actually look closely at our elections, it's amazing that we get 50% in a presidential year. In a non-presidential year, it's 30, 35, and in local races, 20% is the turnout. Absurdly low turnouts. And you say, yeah, what's with these knuckleheads? Why don't they vote? Well, if you actually look at it, they have no news media that covers races, so they're not drawn into races to begin with. There's not oftentimes a lot to vote for. Basically, you're voting for the lesser of two evils. And if you're on the liberal side of the equation, you know, there's plenty to be scared of in the Republicans. But there's really not a whole heck of a lot to be excited about in the Democrats. Every fourth year, you can get out off your butt and say, I hate the Republicans, I'll vote for a Democrat, just keep the Republicans out. But except for that, there's not much the Democrats are doing to get you very excited. And then finally, when you add into the measure, you know, there's very few races that you vote for anymore that are competitive. Their gerrymandering has been done to such a large extent that the vast majority of seats that one might vote for on the ballot, congressional or legislative, have been gerrymandered out of competitive status. So you really don't have a whole heck of a lot to vote for. And that's why I would say it's a great credit to 50% of Americans go out to vote. I think it shows that there's a deep-seated commitment to electoral democracy in this system, when in fact everything in the system is saying to you that it's a joke, it's a farce, and it's sick. You know, I guess that's another way to look at it.
We can extend this also to, say, initiatives and referenda, where you're not even voting for a particular person, but you're going to vote for a policy. And usually those policies are pretty meaningful, and they still generate very inadequately educated types of voting that people are learning from the advertising and not taking the time to learn.
Well, again, I think the system is not really set up. It's not supposed to make people learn. It's not supposed to draw people into public. There's almost no journalism coverage of most of the issues in the Belt. So a person is pretty much reduced to being bombarded with television ads, which I think almost without exception are detrimental, they're worthless, they're horrendous, they're garbage. And a rational person tunes those out, I think, at a certain point. Unless they're extraordinarily knowledgeable, they're on the inside, they see what the games are being played and what the manipulation going on is, and they're in with it because they have a stake in the race. They believe strongly in one side or the other, one candidate or the other. But the whole system is set to produce cynicism and ennui and just sort of have people throw their hands in the air, especially when you look at the you know, over 4 million TV candidate ads or political ads in the year 2012. A majority of those are what are called negative ads. And these are ads that are specifically attack ads on the opponent or the other side of an issue. Many of these ads are paid for by these anonymous third-party groups where you have secret funding that can't be traced. So they can say whatever the heck they want, and it's completely unaccountable. These ads are absolutely cancerous. People hate them, but they're very effective, which is why people do them, which is why so much money is spent on them. In a vacuum where you don't have much of a political culture, you have no journalism to speak of, and this is all you're getting, that's the message that people will remember. And the research is quite clear in this. We document it in the book that, you know, this stuff, as much as people say they hate it outwardly, focus group shows that when people come away from the polls and they say, why did you vote for this candidate, not that one, they recite basically what you hear in negative TV ads.
Well, that said, if we were going to design the perfect media system, how would you go about doing that?
Well, I think the evidence is clear, and it's a bit orthogonal from dollarocracy, but it's certainly relevant, that we have to have the same commitment to building a fourth estate today that the framers of the country had. The framers of the country understood that our whole electoral system was predicated on there being a vibrant press and a news media that drew people into public life. And for that reason, they agreed across the board from Washington and Hamilton to Jefferson and Madison and Franklin and Paine that there are to be heavy subsidies to spawn an independent, large, vibrant newspaper press. And so we had huge postal and printing subsidies, which bankrolled and subsidized this massive press throughout the first 100 years of American history. Basically, postage was all but free, and that was the most important cost after printing to any newspaper was distribution. We had free distribution virtually, which made it possible for lots of newspapers to survive, including virtually the entire abolitionist and suffragist press, which couldn't have survived without the subsidy. And, you know, today we're in a, you know, advertising came along and gave the illusion that journalism could be a commercially solvent enterprise, and it didn't need subsidies. And it actually was a commercially solvent enterprise for the entirety of the 20th century. Owners made a fortune doing newspapers, especially they built the empires and monopolies in city after city. But now with the internet coming along and a variety of other factors, advertising is fleeing journalism. It had provided between 50 and 100% of the revenues in the past, and now it's jumping ship. And as we move to the internet, it's moving to what's called smart advertising, where it no longer even supports media or content producers. It simply goes to whatever website it needs to go to find you, and it just goes by the target audience, not the website or the content provider. And in this new world order, there's absolutely no money for journalism. That's why journalism is shriveling. It's shrinking. It's disintegrating. It's disappearing under commercial auspices. And I think that requires a public policy response. We have to have a massive increase in spending on public and community media. We have to set up independent, uncensored, vibrant institutions, have a pluralistic system. But we have to have a major commitment to journalism and covering our communities. Otherwise, our constitutional system fails.
There's one thing we didn't get to. That has to do with, in this new information age, how personal data has played into what you call dollarocracy.
We did a lot of research on how the internet was being brought into the campaign system in 2012. And, you know, the vision of the internet, and I think the assumption that people make about it routinely is that it's sort of this big, lovely jungle filled with awesome stuff that fills up, and it's just there if you have the time and the brains and the willingness and gumption and diligence to go get it. It's all out there, and you can get the truth about anything. And that's a very comforting vision, but it has all nothing to do with how the Internet has evolved under commercial auspices. Today, the Internet is run by a handful of enormous monopolies that rank among the 10 or 20 largest companies in the United States, if not the world. Google, Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast. I mean, these are all just giant companies. And they've changed the whole logic of the Internet to, instead of like you're anonymous on it, you can go anywhere and get the truth because you can see what everyone else sees. Instead, you're completely unanonymous. Everything we do online is tracked by these companies. They know everything about us. That's what the NSA scandal showed. And they not only know and track everything about us, then they use that information to sell us stuff, this whole smart advertising. It's based on total surveillance. And then every one of us now gets different ads based on who we are, even looking at the same website. And we get different content on websites. We get different answers to searches, depending on who we are, because they know our history, the companies that we use online and advertisers. And what the Obama campaign did for the first time is they applied this new world Internet to the political campaign, and they bought a huge amount of cloud space from the Amazon cloud service. And they put all their data on Americans. They have files on every American voter and non-voters. Lots of information on all of us, and they learned how to direct specific messages to each of us, different messages talking about different issues, emphasizing different sales techniques based on what they know about us from everything we do on Facebook and everything we do online, all the information they've gathered. And it was spectacularly effective. I think that the people on the inside would tell you if there's anything that accounts for why Obama won the election, that was probably it, because they were so far ahead of everyone else. They were so far ahead of even Silicon Valley that after the election, Silicon Valley was going to the Obama headquarters in Chicago, where they had hundreds of these computer whizzes working, and were hiring those guys because they'd done such an extraordinary job of surveilling the American voters and getting out the vote and raising money from their people.
The book, again, is called Dollarocracy, and we're speaking with Robert McChesney, who is one of the co-authors of the book. Thank you so much, Bob McChesney.
My great pleasure, Maria. Thank you for having me.
When we come back, the causes and consequences of an antagonistic, polarized Congress. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. The Senate has, on party lines, confirmed two more nominees to President Obama's cabinet, Thomas Perez to Labor Secretary and Gina McCarthy to the Environmental Protection Agency. The votes came just after Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid threatened the so-called nuclear option that would change the filibuster rules. Before the agreement was made, Republican senators had blocked multiple nominees and policies by filibustering. The tactics were one of many that have been used as partisan warfare in today's very polarized Congress. But it wasn't always this way. How did we come to be so polarized, and what are the consequences? With us are three experts. Sean Theriault is a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of The Power of the People, Congressional Competition, Public Attention, and Voter Retribution, Party Polarization in Congress, and his latest, The Gingrich Senators, The Roots of Partisan Warfare in Congress. Keith Poole is a distinguished chair in the Department of Political Science at the University of Georgia and professor emeritus of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He is the author and co-author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, Ideology in Congress, as well as, in Congress, a political economic history of roll call voting. David Parker is also with us. David Parker is an associate professor of political science at Montana State University. He's the author of The Power of Money in Congressional Campaigns and a contributing author to The Consequences of Divided Government. Welcome to the Scholar's Circle. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with the current situation in Congress. So in the Senate, we've had these Republican senators blocking nominees, policies with filibusters. Harry Reid threatened the so-called nuclear option. And we ended up with a compromise that allowed some of these nominees to at least get through. Sean Theriault, let's start with you. How does your research help us to understand what's going on in the Senate?
I don't think that you can understand the Senate that we observed not only this past week, but the past few months, unless if we understand the Senate that existed before then. In my latest book, The Gingrich Senators, I document how the Senate has been radically transformed by a set of individuals who served with Newt Gingrich in the House, and then they moved to the Senate, and they changed the way the Senate operates as an institution. It no longer is enough to just cast your ballot and get on with your day, but you're going to start standing in the way of compromise. You're going to not only make sure that your opponents lose, but you're going to demean them in the process of their losing. You're going to change the social fabric, the way the Senate operates as an institution. So the trust that is necessary between members starts breaking down. I argue that a group of folks have been at the forefront of this changing dynamic in the Senate, and I label them the Gingrich senators. And then we get a new breed that comes up after the 2010 election called the Tea Party senators, who take all the tactics of the Gingrich senators and they take two steps to the right and push even things that the Gingrich senators can't even believe that they're pushing. But it's all made possible, I think, by the new introduction of the strategies of the Gingrich senators. And it's exactly the tactics of the Tea Party senators that Harry Reid is throwing up his hands in frustration and saying, if this continues, then we're doing the nuclear option and we're going to get these nominees confirmed.
So you see a very strong role in a particular kind of leader who's driving these things. Keith Poole?
Well, I think it's useful to look at this over a long period of time, and that is, since the end of the Second World War, what we've seen are two big key changes. The first is that with the passage of the 64 Civil Rights Act, the 65 Voting Rights Act, and the 1968 Open Housing Act, the South has slowly shifted into the Republican Party, the White South. The effect of that has been to essentially nationalize the Democratic Party so that the Democratic Party in the South is indistinguishable from the Democratic Party outside the old Southern states. So that has moved the Democratic Party partly to the left only because of the shrinkage of the old Southern Democrats. Simultaneously, what you've seen across all regions of the United States is Republicans moving steadily to the right, and they have shifted to the right in every election since 1976. Every new Republican cohort in the House of Representatives has been more conservative than the cohort before. The combination of these two things has made both the House and the Senate almost dysfunctional. The House is basically, because it still has majority institutions, can function. The Senate, I think, is going to fracture probably within the next couple of years. I had thought that the filibuster would dissolve 10 years ago, and I think it's almost inevitable now that it's going to slowly shrink in terms of its effects. The way to understand this current confrontation is now going to be the case that presidential nominees are going to be gotten through the Senate on majority vote, for the simple reason that if the Republicans take back the Senate next year, which I think is possible, if they, for example, get a Republican president in the 2016 elections, they will use this precedent to essentially say that, well, we had this agreement that from now on it was going to be a majority vote. So in effect, you didn't have to do the nuclear option. You just basically did it by implication so that we're going to have a majority vote on presidential nominees. And I think that eventually the vitriol will increase to a point where it'll be very tempting to go to majority votes on judicial nominees as well. We're by no means out of the woods. It's very unlikely that the Republicans will lose the House until after the next census, and so that we're in for a very long period of essentially the parties at dagger points.
David Parker.
Another key component of this that's happening in the Senate, but you know, it's also related to what's happening in the House, is a change in the nature of elections nationally and in Congress, and also the changes in electioneering. So if you go back to the late 19th century and even early part of the 20th century, you used to have these big oscillations in elections. You used to have, it's fairly frequent that you'd have 70, 80 seats lost in the House, or even more than 100 in the House, and also you'd have a lot of seats turnover in the Senate from election cycle to election cycle. But you also had these dramatic elections where, according to some, although other scholars disagree, but some argue there's this kind of engine in the public that builds up pressures over time societally, and then it snaps in an election. You have a critical aligning election, and then you can have a new team come in that pretty much has unified government, and they can then govern. Well, one of the things that seems to have happened, some argue realignment never existed. Well, definitely this realignment engine, if it ever existed, no longer exists. So we kind of muddle through these elections where we don't have these massive swings, where we don't have unified government, where we have fractured government, where we have tight margins in the House and the Senate. And so what that leads to is behaviors by party majorities in the Senate and the House to try to gain an electoral advantage to get that majority so they can govern. So they mess around with things like the filibuster. They mess around with things like congressional investigations. And they do that in order to try to get that governing majority, to try to break through and get enough votes in the Senate and the House in order to govern. The other thing that's happened, Harvard scholar Robert Putman wrote a book called Bowling Alone, talks about the decline of social networks. Well, it's interesting, we've had a really rise of social networks through things like Facebook, through things like Twitter, but while that has made us more connected, it's also made us more selectively connected. There's all kinds of studies showing that people's Twitter feeds and Facebook feeds are aligned only or largely with people who agree with you. So we have an echo chamber in the public, but also among, and Sean's work touches on this, among folks in Congress that essentially talk to each other, builds a pack mentality, a team mentality, not just in Congress, but in the public. And as these folks rile each other up on this team mentality, it gets harder then to compromise. You don't want to talk to anybody. You don't want to agree with anyone. You don't want to reach out across the party lines or party aisles in order to try to make something happen, because the incentive structure is such that you don't want to do that. And not only that, all the messages you're getting from campaigns and electioneering and from what you're watching on TV are reinforcing your own point of view. People are no longer put into situations where they're uncomfortable. They're only in circles that make them comfortable, and that solidifies their position. And the politicians, who take their cues from voters to some extent, but also feed that, there's no incentive to go out there and try to compromise and work together. There's a story I heard when I interviewed Bethine Church, the widow of Frank Church, who said that one day Barry Goldwater called up Frank Church, and of course Barry Goldwater, conservative Republican, and Frank Church is a very liberal Democrat in the Senate. Barry Goldwater said to him on the phone, "Hey Frank, you better get down to the Senate floor because I'm going to bash the crap out of you. You better get down there to defend yourself." And they had this friendship and this connection despite the fact they disagreed. A lot of that, I think, has faded in the current environment and in the Senate and in the House.
It probably doesn't help that we have media that is increasingly polarized as well on the broadcast networks and such. And these tactics, this is something, Sean Thurio, you've written about too, but you've also written about how over the long stretch of history that this is really the most polarized we've seen it since what? Since the Civil War?
That's right. Since the early 20th century. And now we're even battling that polarization that we saw way back in the early 1900s.
Keith Poole, let's bring you back in here. You've written also about how the polarization is also related to income inequality, as well as some of these ideas that Sean Thurial has been documenting in his work with the Gingrich senators. How are they related, this inequality in income and polarization in Congress?
You may make a couple of points in response to my companions, just to reinforce that I agree with them. One of the things that is very clear, this began with a book that I think, I forget the guy's first name, Bishop, wrote called The Big Sort. And more and more and more evidence has now appeared to reinforce the fact that people are moving, that you're getting sorting in the mass public in the sense that they're moving to places to be around people like themselves. And then the revolution in fiber optics, which has allowed the explosion of high-speed transmission of information has allowed people to, again, seek out others like themselves. In terms of inequality, part of that is the fact that there has been a dramatic increase in returns to education over the last 40 or 50 years, so that there is a bigger payoff for getting a university degree than there is for a high school degree, and that gap has steadily widened since the 1950s. The other thing that impacts this is that the lower the education, less likely you are to vote. What you see then is that of those people who vote, they tend to have incomes higher than people who do not vote. And people do tend to vote, say, Republican as their income increases, but there are a number of qualifiers to that. It is a strong enough tendency that Republicans do tend to represent or have a stronger support amongst people who are better off. This then works against redistributive programs. The Affordable Care Act, for example, just barely got through Congress and only got through because the Democrats, for a very limited period of time, had 60 votes in the Senate. Yeah, otherwise, it would have never passed. So that there is strong opposition to new redistributive programs on the part of Republicans. We have to be kind of careful about this, though, because as shown in the Farm Bill fight, both parties like basically having farmers on welfare. And so that one man's welfare program is another man's important subsidy. But it's still the case that inequality is rising fast. It is still increasing, and it flattened out a little tiny bit during the Great Recession, but it's now on the way back up. And neither political party really wanted to reform the financial system to stop essentially the banks and the derivatives traders from making these colossal sums of money. And PBS's Frontline has run a couple of really good specials on this, showing beyond any shadow of a doubt that neither political party has been prepared to do the reforms necessary to stop this, to stop essentially this tremendous piling up of wealth by the Wall Street banks and the derivatives traders and their enablers.
I'm assuming that you're also connecting this with who the representatives are, which would, of course, connect it also into the campaign system, which I think both David and Sean, you've both written about. Sean, you talked about how the campaign money is concentrated in some of these very ideological.
That's right. Right. So, and it's not only the interest groups where there's the consolidation happening, but we also have senators and House members themselves who are establishing these leadership PACs. And so early on in primaries, different members in the House and different members of the Senate are getting behind different candidates. And the types of candidates that they get behind, sometimes there's some disagreement among the parties in who they should support. We've seen that play out recently in both 2010 and 2012 with the Republicans in the Senate, where the establishment was behind someone and then Jim DeMint and the more conservative folks were behind someone else. And it was the early money that they supplied to those candidates that made them get legitimized in the eyes of the public. And so instead of the Republican establishment being the clear favorite that ends up posting a victory in the primaries, you have Jim DeMint, who's leading an army of individual campaign donors who are sending in their $15 to help Joe Miller win in Alaska and help Ted Cruz win in Texas. And these folks are showing up in Washington, D.C., and they're radically transforming the way the institution is operating.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're talking about the causes and consequences of the antagonism and polarization in Congress. David Parker, you've also looked at this in the role of campaign contributions. How do you see this?
One of the things about Citizens United, one thing that's absolutely clear about that decision is it unleashed the power of interest groups to a level that we haven't seen in quite some time. And the effect of that can only be to solidify the positions of individuals and the reluctance to do anything that would be, quote, outside the mainstream of their party for fear of upsetting these interest groups that could just pop up out of nowhere, dump a ton of cash, go away, and you've lost the election. So one of the things that Citizens United has done is created an intense amount of uncertainty in elections. Candidates like to control their own fates. They like to raise their own money. You look at the Montana Senate race that just concluded here in 2012, in which I'm writing a book about. Over $50 million was spent in that race. There are a million people in this state. Karl Rove's PACs alone spent $6.1 or $6.2 million in that race. Now, you can imagine, and that advertising, by the way, started in June. Actually, the first ad started in March of 2011. And you can imagine, right, if you can come in there with a bunch of cash, dump in because you're upset with a candidate, you can have a tremendous effect. That also happened out in California. There was a House seat out there where I think it was Joe Baca. A lot of money came in by the mayor of New York, Bloomberg, last minute, dropped in a very low-key election, and all of a sudden the incumbent loses. So these outside groups with all this cash can basically make it hard, even harder, for candidates to move outside of their party orthodoxy into cross-party lines, because the fear is, you vote the wrong way on this vote, we're going to come get you. And we're starting to see that earlier and earlier. We saw that in the primary elections. And this creates this uncertainty that drives politicians crazy and really, I think, is detrimental to governing. Add to that the other piece of the equation, that now we can go in, understand all these individual voters, what their individual needs are. We can talk to them alone without talking to everyone else. We can motivate them to go ahead and vote on an issue. But issue A for person A, issue B for person B, issue C for person C, we might win an election that way by motivating people to come out and vote on that issue that's burning to them. But what we don't do that allows us to govern is bring together an overall plan or a campaign set of issues that we've campaigned on to the whole electorate that we can then govern on. What we create is a fragmented electorate that we piece together, but that fragmented electorate we piece together to win doesn't allow us to govern in the end. It makes the problem of governance a lot more difficult. We can win elections a lot better today, but we can govern far less ably than we were before.
Which seems to be the result of this kind of polarization.
That's right. This is Sean Thirrell. And I'll just take David's point one step further in the news that we saw this week, and that's with Liz Cheney announcing that she's going to challenge Mike Enzi in a Republican primary for the Senate seat in Wyoming. I would defy Ms. Cheney to find five votes in which she would disagree with Mike Enzi on. And I don't think that she could do it. But she would admit that. And she would say, no, the problem with him is he's even willing to sit down at a table with Democrats. And that is enough for me to think that we just need to get rid of this guy, because sitting down at a table with them legitimizes their initial starting point to such an extent that I just can't even have someone represent me that would believe in even talking to someone who has such strange beliefs. She scared him. And it's because of exactly the phenomenon in which David was just talking about, with all of these interest groups who now have access to all of this money. They're going to dump that in a state that has even fewer people than Montana. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see a Republican primary spend $25, $30 million in a state that has just barely, and maybe not even, 500,000 people.
Dave Parker, I'm going to build off that point, Sean, a little bit. The thing with Mike Enzi is he's a classic example. Since he got into the Senate, he's pushed for the ability of states to be able to collect sales tax off the internet. This is something that concerned him early on. He's a big technology guy. You take that vote, his support for that, as well as support when he was in the state legislature for a temporary tax increase. Oh my goodness, it's Tax Hike Mike. We can take that information there and all of a sudden construct a scenario that Mike Enzi's a tax and spender, Mike Enzi's not a conservative, and he sits down with Ted Kennedy. All those things together, and these outside groups can pour in money, and in an election that normally would have been quiet, but also would have been low-key and low information. So yes, the ability to get involved and engaged earlier because of campaign finance, to go after these people like an Enzi or a Bob Bennett or an Utah or a Dick Lugar is unbelievable.
Keith Poole, how do you see this playing out? You started to lay out some of the legislation in current days. How do you see this affecting our policies?
I think the country is in very deep trouble. Historically, what's unusual about the current political parties is that ever since the rise of the mass political parties in the 1820s, there has almost always been a regional divide that split the both parties internally. Before the Civil War, of course, it was the expansion of slavery in the territories that split both the Democrats and the Whigs. And the latter part of the 19th century was the issue of bimetallism, that is, using both silver and gold as currency. And in the 20th century, beginning during the New Deal, the North-South divide in the Democratic Party So this is the first time, really, in American history since the rise of the two mass parties where you don't have what the old sociologists called cross-cutting cleavages. That is, you don't have a regional differentiation, and in fact, the sorting has resulted in the identifiers of the parties being concentrated within states geographically. But the other thing that is disturbing about the modern alignment is that if you look at what the two political parties stand for, there's no philosophical coherence. They basically stand for basically a collection of issues that underneath do not have any coherent connections in terms of a political philosophy. So that, for example, the Democrats and Republicans are all for, at least they say they are, for free markets, reasonably unfettered capitalism. But on the other hand, they're for essentially restricting access to abortion, they're anti-gay marriage, and other kinds of social issues. On the other hand, the Democrats are fairly liberal, if you want to put it that way, on sort of lifestyle issues, issues regarding, say, the individual. But then again, they are in favor of high regulation of economic activity. So there's no philosophy, like, say, an old-style socialism or whatnot, that basically binds those issues together, bound together solely because people have gotten used to them being together. This raises all sorts of problems because the increasing polarization makes it, as Sean and David have eloquently pointed out, makes it almost impossible to come to sensible solutions to public policies. I can only say this because I'm old now. When I got out of the Army in 1970 and went back to school, there were a lot of World War II veterans on faculties and in positions of responsibility. The World War II generation knew what evil was. They saw evil. They knew evil existed. They fought it. And that gave that generation, as I believe it was Sean or maybe it was David talking about Frank Church, they knew what stakes were. They knew what democracy meant, what it stood for, and why it was worthwhile to try to come together to solve problems. Our current political leadership does not know that. As a consequence, we drift. Problems like, for example, CO2, which we could do something about with some practical policies, are not addressed because of the polarization. We are unable to reform the education system, which is increasingly bureaucratic and not serving the nation well. We cannot reform other of our major institutions. We've militarized law enforcement to a shocking level, and yet we can't do anything about these problems. The war on drugs is an absolute catastrophe, yet you can't get members of either political party to stand up and speak the truth about it. So I'm old, but I'm not completely pessimistic. I see in younger people a more open-mindedness about some of these issues, especially the war on drugs. I'm getting near the end of my academic career, so I can, I think this is going to finally peak and break up.
There's one last piece I really want to cover, and David, this was pertaining to some of the research that you have done, and that is the use of these investigations to sort of attack the other party. We've seen a ton of it with Daryl Issa, but I think your research shows that this has become kind of a regular tool to also thwart the kind of inter-congressional cooperation. Can you describe what you have found with that and what you think its result has been?
What I found is that investigations of the executive branch, specifically of a charge of wrongdoing in the House of Representatives, really have become another tool of this kind of partisan warfare in this era of polarization. So what you see, really starting with Watergate era on, and it could be because of Watergate, could also be because of the increasing staff available on committees during this period, you see that investigations in divided government of the executive branch, first of all, the investigations themselves are more frequent. Second of all, they tend to be longer in terms of the pages produced and the amount of days that you see of those investigations than you see in unified government. So on the one hand, we do have more oversight, and that's good in divided government, but the intensity is dragged on forever. In unified government, alternatively, because the incentive structure isn't there to go after your own administration, you might have an investigation happen, but it's quick, short, and to the point, because you don't want to tarnish the reputation of your fellow co-partisan in the White House. So oversight in and of itself, which is necessary for good government to make sure bad things aren't happening, has now itself been turned into a partisan weapon to basically serve partisan goals. We use the investigations, and hopefully we can dig up enough dirt in divided government to tarnish the executive branch, and maybe they'll help us capture the White House and unify government. We're not going to say anything. We're going to be quiet. Investigations peaked under Bush when the Democrats took over Congress, and then they kind of fade off when Obama becomes president because we have nice unified government.
But now we don't have such unified government, and we've got Daryl Issa driving them. Didn't you see a peak again?
Absolutely. It increased again, looking for more opportunities to try to look out for executive branch malfeasance. Some of these investigations, absolutely essential and legitimate. Some of them, I think, are dragged on for partisan purposes, and the data show that.
Where do you think this is going, Sean Thurial? How do you see this panning out? Will we get a productive government again, or will we see this continuing in this direction?
The only way that we're going to get productive government again is when the electorate says that we want a productive government. The electorate has had chances in 2006, 2008, 2010, 2012 to send moderate, pragmatic problem solvers to Washington. And just about at every turn, they've opted for the person in the primaries who said, not only will I not talk to the opposition, I won't even look at them. And those are the people who are winning primaries. So until those people start losing and we start electing pragmatic problem solvers, we're going to have a government like the one that we've had for the last few years.
Quite fascinating, because then the public says they don't like the Congress anyway, and then they reelect them. Well, thank you to all three of you, Sean Thurial, David Parker, Keith Poole. And Sean Thurial, we look forward to having you back next week to talk more about how Newt Gingrich transformed the Congress into this polarized institution that it is. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're entirely welcome.
Thank you, Maria.
Sean Thurial is a professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of Party Polarization in Congress and his latest, The Gingrich Senators, The Roots of Partisan Warfare in Congress. Keith Poole is a distinguished chair in the Department of Political Science at the University of Georgia and professor emeritus of political science at the University of California, San Diego. He is the author and co-author of books including Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, as well as Ideology in Congress. David Parker is an associate professor of political science at Montana State University. He's the author of The Power of Money in Congressional Campaigns and a contributing author to The Consequences of Divided Government. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @armudian.